From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testified before Congress today. She called what's happening on the southern border a humanitarian crisis, one that justifies President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall.
The projections are dire. The agency is now on track to apprehend more migrants crossing illegally in the first 6 months of this fiscal year than the entirety of FY17.
Meanwhile, Democrats who control the House are struggling to contain a rift over anti-Semitism sparked by Ilhan Omar, the Minnesota freshman Democrat who is one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress. Let's bring our political strategist in, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy and Peter.
Hello. And Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist, joins us today. Hi, Maria.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing well. So let me start with this immigration story. We're hearing about more than double the number of migrants, 76,000 apprehended at the border last month. That's more than double the same period last year. Many of them are families that surrendered to authorities in order to seek asylum. Maria, is this basically helping the president make his case that there's an emergency at the border?
I don't think it is. Not that they won't continue to try to do it. Look, you know, Secretary Nielsen was right. It is a humanitarian crisis. But it's a humanitarian crisis that this president and this administration have made much, much worse. She used the words a chain of human misery. And I agree with her. But part of that misery has been outright caused by this administration, as you have migrants, and you just said it, presenting themselves at the border. They're not trying to cross illegally. They're not trying to hide about what they are trying to do. They want to come in here and seek asylum. I used to be communications director at the former INS under the Clinton administration, and we saw this all the time. People coming over from, back then it was Mexico, now it's Central American countries, where there are huge bouts of violence and death threats by gang members. These are people who literally would face death for themselves or their family members if they did not do something.
Well, Alice,
and they are trying to do what they can.
What about that? Is it, as Maria says, a humanitarian crisis, but not necessarily an emergency worth doing what the president would like to do and build a wall without congressional approval?
Look, the reality is this is a humanitarian crisis, and there's something needs to be done right now. Look, I didn't 100% support the president's decision to declare an emergency and go about it this way. I would have much rather made the steps necessary through congressional approval on the front end instead of on the back end. But look, so often, Democrats and liberals look at emotions and not facts. But those numbers you just read, 76,000 aliens apprehended inadmissible at ports of entry, that's a 12-year high. You can't deny these numbers. The numbers are irrefutable. And that right there, more than anything, gives a cause for Congress to act. And look, Secretary Nielsen made a very important point. This is not a manufactured crisis. This is a real emergency. And I think we all need to understand the catch and release policies of the past are not where we need to go. Republicans and Democrats agree that we need to take action. And if we can come together with not just securing the border, but also looking at the humanitarian aspects and putting more judges along the border to help expedite the process and put more boots on the ground and drones in the air and not just a wall to help secure the border. There are many aspects that need to be done, but we cannot continue to push this to the next administration and the next administration. This was the number one priority for this president. He was elected on a large part this issue, and he's doing what he needs to do to make sure that this happens.
But the problem is that this administration is not doing what Alice just promoted, which is actually smart, to look at real smart border security. This president wants his wall, his wall, his wall. Right now, it is just a vanity project, which will do nothing to stem the flow of this humanitarian crisis, because these migrants are not coming over undeterred areas. They are coming to ports of entry. So if you build a wall, that is going to do nothing to keep them from presenting themselves.
Okay.
It makes no sense whatsoever.
We have to move on because there's a lot to talk about. Democratic Party leaders will be voting on a resolution as early as tomorrow condemning both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim sentiment. And they're not going to name Ilhan Omar. She is the freshman Democrat, as we said, who's been accused of making anti-Semitic comments. The latest that Israel supporters are forcing lawmakers to take a pledge of allegiance to a foreign country. Here's Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney today.
Representative Omar embodies a vile, hate-filled, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel bigotry. This is not a time for politics. This is a time for the Democratic leaders in this institution to do the right thing. They should remove her from the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Maria, looks like this is driving a wedge between new and old school Democrats.
I think that way too much is being made of the quote-unquote wedge. I don't think it's driving a wedge. Are there passionate discussions within the party about what should be included in a resolution? Absolutely. And that is a good thing. And let's just look at the differences between the parties. You know, it's really rich to hear Republicans chastising Democrats about bigotry when they are the party that frankly has members of Congress that promote bigotry, starting with the person at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I am glad that our party is having a discussion about how you broaden and widen the protections and the values and the honor and the respect that we have, not just to the Jewish community, but to the Muslim community, to the Hispanic community, to African Americans, to every multicultural immigrant community out there that has felt the sting of bigotry and hate speech that has been normalized and allowed since President Trump became president.
Alice, does she have a point?
Here's the problem is that instead of addressing the issue of the day and what we're having a conversation, so many Democrats want to flip the script and talk about President Trump. Here's what we need to be talking about. Congresswoman Omar in her deplorable statements saying, talking about Israel is hypnotizing the world and American Jews who support Israel are engaged in dual loyalty. Look, this is out and out anti-Semitic behavior.
It is
not acceptable, and it should be called out for what it is. And for us to try and change the topic of conversation to what may or may not have been said by this president in the past does not do justice to this. Look, who is Congresswoman Omar to decide what is anti-Semitic behavior? If Jewish people take this as offensive language, then we need to accept that. And that is a rule across the board. If any group feels as though language is hurtful or disrespectful or certainly anti-Semitic or racist or however you want to call it, if it is offensive language to a group of people, it needs to be addressed on that
point. Okay.
I completely agree with that. And she apologized several times. Let's just make that very clear. And Democrats came to her to say that what she said was wrong, and she understood that.
And there was also a tweet that I just want to point out when we talk about this by Ilhan Omar. There was a tweet by President Trump during the campaign of Hillary Clinton with a bunch of cash and a Star of David on it that was tweeted out. And I haven't heard him apologize for that.
There's the hypocrisy.
There's the hypocrisy. Okay. I want to talk about 2020 just in the few minutes we have left. We heard this week that Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, is not going to run, that Hillary Clinton told News 12 New York that she is not a 2020 candidate, and that the former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper is running on key issues such as guns and climate change. Here he is.
I'm running for president because we're facing a crisis that threatens everything we stand for. As a skinny kid with Coke bottle glasses and a funny last name, I've stood up to my fair share of bullies.
Maria, let me start with you since you're the Democratic strategist here. What do you think of these different moves on the Democratic side? Bloomberg, Hillary out, Hickenlooper in.
That doesn't surprise me. I always knew Hillary Clinton was not going to run again. You know, there was a lot of much ado about nothing. I think a lot of talk from her ardent supporters and donors who would still like her to be running. But she closed that door a long time ago. It also doesn't surprise me that Michael Bloomberg is not running. I don't see that he sees that there's a path for him, which is why I think he was not running. Hickenlooper, I think, is part of the cadre of Democratic candidates who believe that they have something to offer. And what I'm really excited about is that we're going to have so many talented Democrats with a whole different array of experiences that are focused on the values and the issues that Americans care about. And frankly, all of them are focused on bringing back justice, on bringing back civility, on bringing back humanity, on bringing back, frankly, core American values that have been pushed to the side by this president.
I will say I agree with Maria in that the more the merrier, I believe, in a primary process. We had almost 16, 17 last time in the GOP process. Let the voters decide. Let them decide who represents their views and values and who connects with them.
And who are Republicans most worried about, Alice?
It remains to be seen. We don't know how these people will play out. Mm-hmm. It depends on how they fare in Ohio, in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. But what I see right now, we see a lot of Democrats that are throwing their hat in the ring. We're talking about gun control, climate change, free college, income inequality, abortion rights. And a lot of these candidates are the same on the issues. The question is how this will resonate, not just in the primary, but certainly in the general election, and who has what it takes to take
Maria,
down
I'm
going to
give you a one-word answer. Who do you like the most on the Democratic side so far?
It's got to be two words. First
I like all of them
far. Okay, come on. All right. Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. Alice Stewart, the Republican. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks,
Peter. Thanks, Jeremy.
Medical experts believe our cavalier use of antibiotics has sparked a global health crisis. A recent study shows that 150,000 people died in the U.S. in 2010 from infections that could not be treated with antibiotics. That's much higher than previously reported. But what if doctors could solve the problem by using viruses that have evolved to attack these deadly superbugs? In 2015, epidemiologist Stephanie Strathdee was on vacation in Egypt with her husband, Tom Patterson, when he fell violently ill. A drug-resistant bacteria had infected his abdomen, and Stephanie's race to save his life began. Well, she discovered a little-known treatment that not only cured Tom, but might also prove to be a new weapon in the battle against antibiotic resistance. Stephanie Strathdee and Tom Patterson, both scientists at UC San Diego, have published a book about Tom's brush with death. It's called The Perfect Predator. Professor Strathdee, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Tom Patterson, welcome to you. It's good to hear your voice, to be honest.
To be honest, it's great to be alive.
And let's start with you. Tell me about the day in Egypt when you got sick and you knew this was going to be really bad.
Well, we started off on this really wonderful trip in Egypt, exploring pyramids. We were on the top of the ship, had a beautiful starlit dinner that night, and went to bed. And about an hour later, I woke up and I was violently throwing up, assumed that I had food poisoning, and it just kept going and going and going all night long. And in the morning, Stephanie said, I'm calling a doctor, and I'm one of those stoic guys who likes to say, no, I don't want to see a doctor, especially when you're in a developing country.
Because you've traveled a lot in your lives together.
Oh, yeah. We visited well over 50 countries, and so we carry ciprofloxacin in case we get something. In fact, that's the first thing we did was I popped one of those pills and promptly threw it up.
It was an antibiotic, ironically. And so, Stephanie, you seems like you're worried at this point, but you're not overly worried. However, you do find yourself in a hospital or a clinic in Luxor. At what point do you out that the big picture problem with Tom was this bacterial infection that could not be treated with antibiotics?
Within a couple of days, I managed to convince our travel insurance company to get a medevac to Frankfurt, where they did a CT scan and they saw that there was a giant abscess in his abdomen the size of a small football. And the doctor showed me this flask of brown, putrid, murky fluid and said, based on this fluid and the color of it, there's something growing in there and we have to culture it to see what's in there. So a couple of days later, it came back and the doctor came into the room at the ICU fully gowned and gloved and stood a distance away and said, it's the worst news we could have had. I'm afraid it's the worst bacteria on the planet.
And what was it?
It's called Acinetobacter baumannii. And soon afterwards, the WHO, a World Health Organization, listed this organism as the most deadly superbug to human health. It was a wimpy bacterium a couple of decades ago. It's one, though, that is what I consider to be a bacterial kleptomaniac. Hmm. It steals antimicrobial resistance genes from other bacteria and has become a superbug.
So there was a time when you could treat this infection with antibiotics, but you couldn't now in this case with Tom, and it was making him incredibly, incredibly sick. What changed? How did it go from being this wimpy bug, as you describe it, to something that was going to kill him?
Well, Tom, unfortunately, now is the poster child for this dystopian age of the global superbug crisis. We have been overusing antibiotics, not just in people, but in livestock and agriculture and even aquaculture. And as a result of this, bacteria have been acquiring resistance genes. And this particular superbug got really clever about moving into spaces where we've knocked out other friendly bacteria in the microbiome.
Hmm. So you need a solution and you need one fast, Stephanie. You luckily are a scientist. You have some experience in this world. And you come across something in your reading of medical journals called phage therapy. Tell us more.
Phages are actually viruses that attack bacteria. They have evolved over millennia. They're 100 times smaller than bacteria, and they're everywhere. They're in soil, they're in water, they're in our guts. And so as a result, we poop them out. And where you find phages are where you find cesspools full of bacteria.
And you actually convinced scientists around the country to go searching in sewage for these things.
It was actually miraculous. I reached out to total strangers around the U.S., which included a group from Texas A&M University, who turned their lab into a command center and basically worked on this 24/7 for the next few weeks and found phages that matched Tom's bacterial isolate. The FDA put us in touch with a group from the Navy Medical Research Center in Frederick, Maryland, and they, too, found several phages that matched Tom's bacterial isolate. So now we had two phage cocktails that were sent back to us. These had to be repurified by San Diego State University because when we realized that we had to inject these into his bloodstream, we wanted them to be as pure as possible. If they weren't, it could trigger septic shock and kill him.
Now, phage therapy is not new, and that's the fascinating thing about this. It actually was first discovered about 100 years ago, but then it went out of favor with the use of antibiotics. Why did we just forget that they were there and could help with these infections?
Phages were considered very finicky. You have to match the phage to the bacteria. Not just any phage will kill any bacteria. And also, in the former Soviet Union, they had taken up phage therapy very vigorously. They didn't have access to antibiotics very easily. And because Russia was an enemy to the West, if you were a proponent of phage therapy, you were considered a pinko commie scientist.
Wow. So that's what you're up against. And Tom, I want to bring you back into this conversation because this phage therapy now is going to be injected inside your gut to target the infection. It's also going to be put into your body intravenously. But at this point, you were on your deathbed. What was that like? I mean, did you have any idea of what was going on or the grave danger that you were in?
I was actually in a coma, having hallucinations, and Stephanie came to me, and I was able to hear her, actually, even though I was in a coma. That's one of the interesting facts that I try to get out to people is when you talk to people and they're in a coma, don't assume that they're just a loaf of bread. Hmm. They can hear you sometimes. And she asked me if I wanted to live, and I, at that time, was hallucinating I was a snake, of all things. And I had to find out how to squeeze her hand to let her know that I wanted to live. And I wrapped my body around her hand and squeezed it, and she went ahead and did her thing as a scientist.
And Stephanie, it started to work.
3 days after we started injecting phages into Tom's bloodstream, he woke up. He lifted his head off the pillow and kissed his daughter's hand. I wasn't there at that particular moment, but I know that the ICU just exploded and everybody was giving high fives and tears were streaming down people's face. And when I ran into the hospital the next day to see Tom, unfortunately, he was septic again. Hmm. He was in a coma and we thought that we were killing him. We stopped the phage therapy, and we realized within a day that it was another bacteria that had got out of his gut. So we restarted the phage therapy, and 2 days later, he woke up. And from then, he was making a full recovery. And it was the happiest day of my life, to be honest.
Not to be morbid, but if Tom had died, and it was close, do you think the advancement of phage therapy would be moving forward like it is today?
That's a very good question. I mean, clearly the success of Tom's case went viral, and in a good way this time. And a lot of people are now using phage therapy intravenously around the world where they hadn't been doing this before. But even if Tom died, I knew that we were both scientists and that we would at least be offering some information about what to do or what not to do. And we monitored this very carefully. The case report was published. We've now treated several other cases successfully, not just at UC San Diego, but around the world.
Tom, what about you? This completely ravaged your body. You lost 100 pounds. You mentioned the hallucinations that you suffered while you were in a coma for many, 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 many days. 9 months, was it, in the hospital total when it was all said and done?
That's right. I was in a coma for 2 to 3 months, and I was in the hospital a total of 9 months.
How are you doing now?
I'm doing great. I'm back to work. We just came back from Costa Rica, bird watching and hiking. But I have to say, for every day you're in the hospital, it's 5 days of recovery. So I'm 3 years out of the hospital, and it's about 4 years to get a full recovery. So I'm still regaining strength.
Has it shifted your view on what it means to be alive?
No question about it. I mean, I have to say, it's a very emotional experience. You take a physical toll, but you also get a psychological toll. Myself, Stephanie, my daughters suffer from PTSD as a result of this. But I'm here to talk about this because I'm trying to pay forward what all of the people that went out of their way contributing phages and all their knowledge to save my life. And so what I'm hoping is my experience will result in saving many, many more lives.
That's Thomas Patterson and Stephanie Strathdee. They are authors of the new book, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. Thanks for sharing your story, and we're happy it turned out the way it did, to say the least. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And if you want more information, we'll link you to the Phage Therapy Center at UC San Diego. Professor Strathdee and Tom's doctor started it after Tom's incredible recovery. HereAndNow.org. Today is Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the Christian season of Lent. Historically, it's a time of repentance, but as Dina Prichep reports, more churches are using the ritual to reflect on mortality itself.
The intensive care unit is a difficult place to be. The beeping of machines, the bandages, the blood. Chaplain Fernando Serna walks the halls of Oregon Health and Science University, providing spiritual counsel.
A sick person is facing the demise of their body, the smells of their body, and their families can't really turn away from that either.
And Serna helps them face some difficult truths.
You know, one of my privileges in the hospital is I facilitate conversations with patients and families when it becomes clear that, you know, this road is only leading towards an end of life.
Ash Wednesday is one of the few days where the fact that we're going to die is said out loud. The liturgy includes the admonition, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." But in the early days of the church, people didn't need to be reminded of death. It was all around. And Ash Wednesday was about repenting for a special group of people called penitents.
Who would have committed one of the big sins, murder, adultery, and apostasy?
Tim O'Malley teaches theology at Notre Dame University.
Starting in the 5th and 6th centuries, it moves from just a season for penitence to more broadly the whole church.
Instead of isolating sinners, the entire community would receive a sprinkling of ashes on their heads and be reminded that they will all return to dust. If that sounds a little ominous, according to theologian Ben Stewart, it kind of was.
There were certainly times in the Middle Ages when it was almost like pronouncing a curse or a punishment on people, as if being a mortal creature was like plan B.
Stewart is a professor at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. And he doesn't think death is some punishment for sin. Things that are born just die, and they return to dust.
These words are actually a kind of welcome honesty, that this is plan A, that we're mortal creatures rightly returning to the earth, and that our culture actually doesn't give us that message often enough.
But it's still a hard message. And so, he says, we ritualize it to face mortality together.
This day of Ash Wednesday, in many ways, has taken on the kind of existential weight that regular funeral practices used to do.
Modern life doesn't stop for funerals as much as it used to. And even when people attend memorial services or celebrations of life, there's often no body there.
The fact that we're putting ashes on each other in a society where more and more people are committing our loved ones' bodies to the fire to become ashes and bone fragments, there's a kind of resonance there.
Stewart says we want these mortal encounters. That's why Ash Wednesday is such a well-attended service for both Catholics and Protestants. Because this brush with death, literally, across the foreheads of everyone, from the oldest members of the congregation to newborn babies, can anchor people in life.
It allows people to kind of recalibrate. Who are we as a society of dust creatures? Who do we want to be?
We may want to be immortal, but we're not. And acknowledging that, Stewart says, in public, in community, doesn't have to be a curse. It can be an invitation to turn and wonder at the lives we choose to live. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
The Trump administration is considering new sanctions against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Opposition leader Juan Guaido returned to Venezuela this week after traveling to other Latin American countries. Maduro had threatened to arrest Guaido for violating a government travel ban, but he has made no moves to do so. The U.S. and about 50 other countries recognize Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate leader, but Maduro is not giving up the presidency and still has the support of the military. So what does all this mean for the 32 million people still living in Venezuela? Let's hear from one of them. Elimar Gutierrez is an English teacher and translator in Barquisimeto, Venezuela. She's on Skype. Elimar, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So first of all, how are you feeling right now? We've been watching all of the headlines now, Guaido back in the country. What does it feel like to be there?
Well, really, every day it's like a new adventure. You will never know what to expect. There is always something new, always something to struggle with. We watch the news every day, or, well, not so much the news, because right now our national television doesn't offer much information. But we are like with the Twitter and with Instagram, and that's the way we communicate or receive the information.
What do you mean the national television doesn't offer much information?
Well, there are some restrictions in national television and radio shows also. And actually right now they have banned to talk about Juan Guaido. They cannot even mention his name.
Mm-hmm. And what about life for you right now? We've been hearing about food shortages and gas shortages and terrible inflation. Just give us a sense of what it is like for you right now in Venezuela.
Yeah, well, I could tell you, for example, last year for us to buy groceries for about a week for a family of four, we would spend about $50 each week. And now it's $100 each week. So the prices are increasing not only in our own currency, but also in other currencies. So that's how big the inflation has affected us. Of course, every time the Maduro decides to offer a raise in the minimum wage, well, everything goes up because, of course, the companies have to adapt to those new costs and payments for their employees.
Is it difficult to find food and supplies?
It's difficult to find food, yeah. And everything here is imported. I'm talking about like really basic stuff. I would say, for example, rice and pasta, for instance, or the corn flour that we use for our breakfast, for our national breakfast. So those things have to be imported. And when they are not imported, so at least one of their ingredients or elements are imported. So that always increases the price of things. And that's why also it's hard to find them in big quantities. So you would find queues to find food and to get something. We have an ID, okay? We have every citizen has an ID. So with the last number of your ID, there is a day that you can go to the supermarket and buy something.
Rationing.
That's right. Hmm. That has been seen a little less this year, yeah, but it's still happening. Last year, 2 years from now was like so strong that even the companies had to let their employees just go whenever they had to go and buy their supplies.
What about getting money out of the bank?
That's a very hard topic. For instance, right now, if you go to an ATM, the top that you could get is 500 bolivares. Transportation fare would be about 200, 300 for just one ride. And that depends also on the area that you live. So in order to get a little more money, you have to go inside the bank. And also you have to state why you're asking for a larger amount of money, what you're going to do with that. So yeah, it feels like, okay, this is my money. Why am I supposed to tell her what I'm going to do with this? So it doesn't feel well.
And what about politically? You're supporting Guaido?
Yes, I am.
And do you fear repercussions because of that support? Are you scared to talk about that publicly?
Well, yeah, a little bit sometimes. For example, those demonstrations that we have been going to, you have to be really, you know, attentive of the people that surround you because you never know if they are informants or... So, yeah, you have to keep an eye on that. And especially younger people that if they are not in a group, they could be taken. Let's say when they are apart from the group, so the police can come and take them just because they were demonstrating. Hmm.
Do you know people who have been taken by the police?
Yeah, actually a neighbor from here, he was taken about 2 years ago. And he cannot leave the country. He has a restriction.
Have you thought about leaving the country?
Well, really, I haven't thought about it because I have all my family here. Well, almost all of them, at least the closest one, my parents. But my sister left in December. I have many cousins and friends also who have left the country. It's really hard for them, too. Actually, my stepson also left recently, about 2 months ago. The difficulty is that for young people to stay here is harder because they try to go to school or the university to find that teachers are gone. There are not enough teachers. So it's really difficult. Some universities right now are using kind of an online system in order to finish their studies. So for a young person just finishing high school, it's hard to find that reality.
But you're basically staying because of your family at this point.
Well, yeah, and because also we have been... I would say blessed because 2 years now I started working as an online teacher and I had the opportunity to work with an American company. So I'm receiving foreign currency with my payments are like that. So I've been able to sort of deal with the situation and help my family. That's another reason why I'm staying here. But it's hard. It's hard because, for example, to get your groceries, you have to go to several places because not all supermarkets are stocked. So you have to go and find your groceries in many different places, let alone finding the cash. Also having to make a line for getting your gas for your car. So it makes it a little complicated.
Do you have hope for Venezuela?
Yeah, I do. Actually, right now we are very hopeful. I think things are going slow but surely, so I think this is something that is going to lead us to another situation, a new situation that is going to be better for us. I think it's going to take a little while, but yeah, I'm full of hope right now.
Do you think that Maduro will step down willingly? Do you think that there will be a war? What do you think will happen?
Yeah, well, that's our idea. That's what they have let us know, that they won't leave the power just like that. So, yeah, that's what we fear, that probably there will be confrontation and civilians could be involved, and that's what we fear, yeah.
How do you feel about the United States' action when it comes to Venezuela, standing by Guaido, recognizing Guaido, and threatening that it may get further involved, even leaving the military option on the table to try to get rid of Maduro?
Our reaction when Trump stated that he was supporting us was very important for us. We know how important the U.S. is in the region, and the actions that they have taken and the support that they have shown, it means that, well, they are doing things very strategically, and they are really involved in this. So that really makes us feel a little more quiet, let's say.
There are some, though, that are worried about U.S. intervention in Venezuela, given the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America in general. Do you have any concerns about U.S. involvement?
Well, the thing is that we have a lot of intervention already. Maduro and Chavez brought a lot of people from different countries, and they are the ones that are occupying even positions that are supposed to be occupied by Venezuelans. So we have Cuban intervention, we have Russian intervention, we have terrorist intervention. So that's kind of ironic for the ones that say that the U.S. are being in our country and, you know, calling them the imperialists.
That is Elimar Gutierrez, who is an English teacher and translator living in Barquisimeto, Venezuela. That's about 5 hours away from Caracas. Thank you so much for joining us and good luck.
Thank you. Anytime.
This week marks 5 years since the mysterious disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. The flight traveling from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing was carrying more than 230 people when it went missing, prompting two failed search missions, the first of which cost $141 million. The second one ended last May. Now Malaysia's transport minister is considering relaunching the search for the plane if exploration companies provide credible leads. Joining us now is Seth Kaplan, editor at Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this is being called the world's greatest aviation mystery. Previous search efforts, as we've talked about very, very much, didn't produce anything. Why would they want to do a new search effort, or why do they think that it would yield something different?
Well, these companies say technology has evolved to where they could give themselves a better chance of finding it. But Jeremy, you know, scientists have said we know less about the ocean floor than we do about the surfaces of planets like Mars and Venus. And for perspective about how daunting this is, my mind goes to another crash 10 years ago, Air France flight 447 off the coast of Brazil. Yeah. It took 2 years to find most of the wreckage and the black boxes on the bottom of the ocean floor, even though investigators knew just where that plane went down. That's how hard it is. And so, you know, if anything, the bigger question is sort of whether going forward, if something like this happens again, we might have a better idea of where indeed the plane went down. Because in this case, we barely know what part of the world it went down. And I talked today to one of the suppliers of a new system that Malaysia Airlines has signed up for. They were actually, not coincidentally, probably the first airline in the world to say they would do this, sign up for a new system, satellite tracking. A company says that that system's in the final testing stage, is already more or less working and should be fully operational. That's flight aware within a few weeks at a bunch of airlines around the world.
Seth, this is Peter. I just want to ask you, I mean, the searches are so incredibly expensive. Are these companies really even motivated to look?
Well, the deal that Malaysia's government might make with one of those companies would be basically on a contingency basis, you know, where the company is taking the risk, saying we'll do this, and then you pay us, the company saying this, a lot of money if indeed we find the wreckage. So, you know, that shows that they must be somewhat optimistic. Again, though, if they did find the wreckage, I mean, there's just no precedent for solving a mystery quite like this.
One other story I want to ask you about in aviation. Southwest Airlines offering new flights to Hawaii starting March 17th. Tickets are starting at $49 each way. Southwest competitors have already started lowering their fares to Honolulu to compete, and I'm hoping that you can tell me that this is a race to the bottom for a fare to Hawaii.
Yeah, Peter. Well, very clearly, those $49 fares wouldn't be sustainable, right? Airlines would quickly start losing money if they did that on a long-term basis. I think you said it there. Limited time only. Not very many of the $49 fares. But look, this is a major new competitor in the marketplace, not only between the West Coast and Hawaii, but even between the islands. Southwest doing some of those ultra-short-haul flights. In those cases, charging as little as $29. Wow. So yeah, things have changed in Hawaii.
I think this calls for a remote broadcast from Honolulu so we can really get to the bottom of this story. We'll just fly back and forth. Seth, another story that is popping up in the airline world this week, and I was surprised that this is even still going on, but maybe I shouldn't be. Virgin Atlantic announced that it is no longer requiring its female flight attendants to wear skirts or makeup. It's surprising that they were even still required to do that.
Yeah, and it's one of those legacy things, Jeremy, that a new airline launching today in most parts of the world is probably not going to even think to do that. But it just sort of always existed at these old airlines, and they're gradually relaxing these standards. But these airlines still have they're books. They call them image standards, and they're big enough. Like, there's a table of contents at the beginning, for how many pages there are, about all kinds of things, including, standards for facial hair on men, for example. They regulate all of that. They're doing less of it all the time, but it's still very much
United Airlines still prohibits men from wearing earrings or studs. Czech Airlines requires attendants to meet a certain body mass index requirement.
Yeah, requirements for height and for weight. In some cases, airlines will say, that's because of safety. Somebody who's too short or too tall, perhaps, to do certain tasks, but also very much about image. Definitely, cultural considerations come into play. There are standards at certain airlines around the world that you would not see in the U.S. or perhaps Western Europe, let's say. But this takes time. We're getting there.
Seth, as the son of a former flight attendant, I feel like I need to point out here that the number one job of a flight attendant is to make sure you get off the airplane if there is an emergency. So even having this conversation about whether or not they're wearing makeup or that got high heels on or pants, I mean, that's not the point of the job.
Right, and they say it at the beginning of the safety demonstration, a lot of airlines, right? They say, we're here primarily for your safety, mm-hmm. but also for your comfort and so forth. And yet you juxtapose that against, what I think a lot of people were surprised to hear in terms of those standards on lipstick, at least, and skirts being relaxed at Virgin Atlantic.
Seth Kaplan, editor at Airline Weekly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy and Peter.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.